The question then is the Yetzara. What is the Yetzara? The Yetzara is the instinctual part of Adam. Now, why is that called Ra? That is what's Ra about it. Is there anything evil about man's instinct to be appetitive?
The instinct for food,
the instinct of self-preservation, the sexual instinct, is that Ra? Well, how do you say it's Ra? It's part of the Kriya. It's God created. Finish your question. What is the Yetzer HaTov? Is the Yetzer Hara the evil inclination? And by the way, I wonder, now that you raise it, what do most people, you know, people that study Torah, what do most from people think the Yetzer Hara is? If not, well, how do they, what do they think? There's a certain Yetzer Hara? In other words, there's a certain force in man which is just the Yetzer Hara, which just wants to do evil, and we have to fight against it? In other words, how did you understand this before this explanation? I said, no, the Yetzer Hara is not a special element in man, it's just the instinctual part of man, and we'll explain why it's called Ra. Well, I mean, I'm far removed from the other way of thinking. And I guess as a kid, I was raised, you know, with the standard way of understanding. Does that mean, I've forgotten, most people believe that there's a Yetzer Hara, there's like that bad guy in there, that Yetzer Hara that's your enemy, your opponent, like a real threat in him, the internal one. And that just wants to get you to sin, right? And you got to fight that guy. And the good one is the good guy. So there's two guys in there fighting it out. Is that the basic idea? Oh. Well, it's the Yetzer Hara of the heart of Ram and Urav. The inclination of the heart of man is evil in Urav, from youth, from birth. It's very well, it's misunderstood. It's a very misunderstood prophet. People misunderstand it. And that's, but the answer is, as you say, the Yetzer Hara comes into effect much later than the Yetzer Hara. I'll try to explain these ideas. First of all, the instincts are the Yetzer Hara. Now, the instincts are not the Yetzer Hara inherently. There's nothing inherently evil about any instinct. But the reason why it's called Ra is relatively speaking. And I'll prove this to you from the Maamar Chazal. Because it means that they have a certain tendency to pull us in a certain direction, which, in other words, which leads us to do the Ra. In other words, most of the sins, most of the distortions that people are involved in, distortion of reality, and pursuit of the wrong things, is because of the evil inclinations which overpower them. But they're not inherently Ra. Because as a Chazal would say, it says that you should serve God with both of your yitzros, with your Yetzer Hara and your Yetzer Hatov. You should serve God. You never heard that Chazal? You never heard that Chazal? B'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol miyadecha, b'chol levavcha, right? B'shtei yitzirecha, with both of your Yetzer. Now how could it be, if the courtesy of maintaining the other idea of the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is simply that wicked force that has to be overcome, and has to serve God with that wicked force. But if the idea is it's the instinctual, so then you have to serve God, you can serve God with the instinctual as well, your instinctual energy. For example, I'll use a very simple example. There's many levels to understand this on. If a person has aggressive tendencies, warlike inclinations, and wants to be a warrior, so he could serve God, he could become a soldier and then fight the wars of God. He could sublimate his energy. By serving God, it means to sublimate your energy. Now, what is the Yetzer Hara? The Yetzer Hara is used in two senses. In one sense, the Yetzer Hara is basically the other, it's an inclination, which means the conscience, the superego, the other set of emotions. In other words, the emotions that run counter to the instinct. The emotions of shame, the emotions of guilt, the emotions of identification, compassion, and so on and so forth. That's called the Yetzer Hara. Now, why is that the Yetzer Hara? And why does it say, now isn't it absurd to say to serve God with the Yetzer Hara? The Yetzer Hara is inherently serving God. Who is being addressed over here? Who is the one that's supposed to take the Yetzer Hara and take the Yetzer Hara and use them both? Who? If the Yetzer Hara is the, as most people think, that's the good part, that's the good force, so that's serving God by nature. The answer is that there's another set of emotions which we call so because they have the tendency to pull us in the other direction, the direction of the good. But they're not inherently good. Because take any emotion that you have, the emotion of compassion. It's so. It's a good emotion because by and large it will lead you to perform good actions and it will prevent you from doing bad actions. But it's not inherently good because Kalamarachim al Achzar. Sofo lios achmer al rachmanim. Whoever is merciful to the cruel, in the end will be cruel to the innocent. That's the case of Shaul. So Shaul's sin was what? That he gave in to his yetzer hatov, to the emotion of compassion, when it came when it wasn't supposed to be utilized. So who is the chazal being addressed to? The seichel ha'adam, the tzelem elokim. In other words, the one who served God, the part of man that's involved in the service of God is the Tzelem Elokim. It's Chachmah. And everything has to be done with Chachmah. He's got to utilize. God wants you to utilize the energy to satisfy the instincts have to be satisfied, but the determination has to be by the Seichel HaAdam, in line with the true purpose of Adam. And the same is true with the Yetzer HaTov. The fact that a person just follows the Yetzer HaTov, he can be wicked. He can be evil. He can allow Rishayim. He can be Merachim al-Aqsa. He allows Rishayim to go free. You see, that's what the world is suffering from today. There's so much, why is there so much crime and so on? Because they give in to these weak emotions, the emotions of pity and compassion, and they can't have a death penalty, can't put them in jail, can't punish. So people have lost all fear, have lost all respect for human life, and that's the most destructive thing. The Yetzer HaTov can be the most destructive thing. Be just as harmful. So these are relative terms. The Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov are relative terms. But what makes it good is only when it's utilized in accordance with Chachmah. So that's what he says. That the Nachash is the Satan. The Satan is the Yetzer Hara. And maybe not today. If you ask me what would be the concept, somebody once asked him, what's the idea of a Arda? That's a Satan. To confuse the Satan. How can you confuse the Yetzer Hara? But not now. You'll have to remind me. Now, the next question then is, why is it depicted as a snake? Why is the Yetzer Hara symbolized as a snake? Rav HaHezek performed a great deal of damage in miyut heyoto nira, because it's not visible. In miyut means the minimal, right, a small amount. In other words, because the fact that it's not seen, it's not visible. Now, let's try and understand that. What's the idea? The Yetzer Hara is a snake. Why would you depict it with a snake? Because it's a great deal of harm because you don't see the snake. Now, what's the idea? How does that translate? What's the nimshal? There's the mashal and the nimshal. What does that tell us about the Yetzer Hara? It's meant to tell us something. Yeah, it's very subtle. And what is the major subtlety of the Yetzer Hara? It's Orem. That's why it's called cunning. You see, that's why it's very, very cunning. I think another idea is that, see, the snake sort of blends into the environment, camouflage, so to speak. It hides behind something else. Now, the reason why the Yetzer Hara is so difficult is because it's very subtle. It always hides behind something else. It masquerades. You follow what I'm talking about? Yes. Rationalization. You see, it's very sophisticated, and most of the Rishonim in the world. Most of the Rishonim will succeed because they're able to convince people that the real reason to follow them, they're able to couch their instinctual objective in the form of an idealism. That was the so-called, I hate to use the term genius, but you have to recognize it, the evil genius. Churchill refers to Hitler, Yimach Shmo, as an evil genius. His evil genius was in the fact that he was able, how did he get a whole nation to follow him on his path? He was able to take a program of of hatred and destruction and make it appear like a exalted form of idealism. We're preserving the master race and so on and so forth. But everybody does this. In other words, very, very rare, when a person wants something and it's basically rooted in an instinct, they'll always try and find ways to show that it's really an ideal. We'll start this thing, we'll start this program, this. Very often it's an ego thing. Very often he wants recognition. You see? And the motive, the danger is, though, that it has the capacity to hide itself. And when it hides itself, it's able to convince the person that the real reason why he wants this is because of idealistic reasons. Now, once he believes it's idealistic, then, you see, that's the whole threat, that he can't stop a person. The most dangerous person is an idealist. An ordinary instinctual person, you see, that's why an ordinary Russia, like a mafioso type, just a Baltaiva, can't do too much harm. But a Hitler is a person who's able to masquerade. The one who's able to carefully masquerade his objectives, he's the dangerous one. It's a guy like Duke, like David Duke in the election now. See, as long as he was openly going around with the KKK and the Nazis, so then he wasn't such a big threat. Because in this day and age in America, people are not going to buy it. Even people that inwardly might hate the blacks or the Jews, but openly they can't accept it. But once he's dangerous because he's subtle, and he's able to say that he's given that up, and that's not his program. His program really is something else. He just wants to preserve it. It's not anti-black. Every group wants to preserve its own heritage. It's now become, it's not the master race, the white race. It's just the white Christian heritage. That's all it is. It's a very calm, soothing kind of thing. And he's very, very smooth. He's very smooth. I saw him, he was on Donahue recently. Amazing performance. Amazingly, thank God that most of them, you see, most of them are, the guy like that, if he's elected, I mean, it's bad for guys that to be elected, but in a sense, he'd do more harm recruiting people for the KKK than when he's in office and he's in the spotlight, and he can't espouse these ideas. It's a question of where can he do more harm. But the point is, he was amazing. And he was in New York with a basically hostile audience. They started out extremely hostile. And they showed, Donahue showed clips of what he had done in the past, said in the past. And he was extremely skillful. He never got angry. And he basically disarmed his audience. And he says, look, I'm admitting I was wrong. Who has not, you see, of course, who has not sinned in his life, of course, for a Christian audience, who at different times in their life hasn't had malice in their heart? So I had malice in my heart, and I realized it was wrong, you know, it's that kind of thing. Of course, I mean, so you can't, that's a stupid argument. I mean, of course, everyone's had anger in their heart, but this man was an advocate of, programs, Nazi-like programs for many, many years of his adult life. That's not just the case of having had malice. The point is, he was able to convince his audience. They asked him for one girl asked him, well, what if you're, that's what they asked him about, that he had denied the Holocaust. And Donnie let him off the hook on a lot of this stuff. He could have cornered him much better. He says, no, he agreed that atrocities occurred in Germany. He never really forced him to say, well, what about the Holocaust? You let him off the hook. And that it was wrong, you know. He's changed. So someone asked him, what if his daughter was to marry a Jew or a black? What would he do? So, you know, that seemed to catch him off guard a little bit, but he recovered very quickly. And he said that he has a lot of acquaintances, friends with Jews, that are Jews, and made a lot of... And he says, I respect the Jews. And he says, but the thing that's come across to me, from most of the Jews that I know, feel very strongly about their children marrying out of their faith. It's true. So that's the way I would look at it, because I want to preserve my faith. And therefore, I wouldn't disown them, but I would be opposed to it. You know, so that sounds very smooth. It's reasonable. Jews don't. Jews objective. So what about marrying a black? Well, he wants to preserve his heritage. They could have clipped him. Because the black is a Christian. A Christian black. That answer wouldn't hold anymore. Well, he's preserving a certain heritage. You see? So, he's an extremely dangerous individual because he has the ability to appeal to all of the latent instinctual forces without the person ever having to admit that that's really what he's pursuing. He can really be convinced that he's in pursuit of a noble ideal. So the most dangerous people throughout history have been the idealists. Christianity, for example, was more Jews died as a result of Christianity than Nazism throughout history. Now the Christian, why is he so dangerous? Because it's basically an aggressive, position, the hatred of the Jew. So he has an outlet for all of his hatred, all of his aggressiveness, and he thinks he's doing it. To start as a, you know, the whole ideology that goes behind it. And that's why the communists. The communists, when they reign supreme, they commit the worst atrocities. Just as bad as the Nazis, what Stalin did, I mean, and to the Jews too, it's just that he would have done the same thing. It's just that he had other enemies or whatever. He had his own. They killed, in the purges, how many millions of Russians were killed? And they set a conservative estimate. I have heard 30 million, I mean. So, the worst brutalities. Why? Because it's a missile. So, the idealists are the most dangerous ones. And that's the idea of the Eight Tahara. That's the depiction of the snake, because of the cunning. The first person is very careful. And that's the idea, by the way, of La'arvah and Hasatan. That's how I explained it. That we do certain things before, because what's Shofar? Shofar is really a call to Tshuva. Uli Yishena Mishnyasem. Wake up from your slumber. You're involved in fantasy. Wake up. So, we do certain things. We make certain changes. We stop blowing the shofar the day before. We blow it this way, that way, to confuse the satan. What does it mean? The satan is the Eight Tahara. So what are we confusing? I want to say like this. It means we're about to enter a war. The shofar is a call to war, to do battle with your instincts. Now, a person has a tendency to overestimate himself, to overestimate his own ego. Yeah, I could do it. A smoker. I know. I can give it up anytime I want. Whenever you point, if a person is on the level where he can admit that he has a fault, if you find such a person, I know I have that thing, but when I'm ready, I'll give it up. It's no big deal. I can give it up. You know, the addict always denies that he's addicted. So the same thing. A person has a tendency to believe that he's in control, and he can do truth anytime he wants. So what they're trying to tell you is, no. Just like if you were going out to war, you'd use stratagems, you'd have respect for your enemies, you'd use seichel, you'd want to have intelligence, information, and devise a plan, because you recognize the power of the enemy. So too, do certain stratagems to confuse, which means to bring home the point that you're up against an enemy that's very, very smart. The Eight Tahara is very smart, might be smarter than you are. It gets up earlier than you, it works while you're asleep. And it's up to you. In other words, don't overestimate yourself. Recognize that it's not just a simple thing to be true, and that your own the will per se is not enough. You got to use seichel, because you're up against an enemy that's very, very cunning. That's the idea of larvae. That's my interpretation. So, dialogue. The dialogue, as I said, that we're not taking, according to DeFerno, we're not taking literally. In other words, he wasn't talking to an external snake. But it's a dialogue between the Torah depicting it. Two forces within the woman are battling. She's fighting against her yetzer, her instinct, her desire, to partake of the fruit of the tree. Now, what is the idea of the punishment? The idea of the punishment, then, we have to follow through with Sforno. It means to say that God brought about, as a result of the chait, certain changes occur in the Eight Tahara. That's the sense in which we're going to try and understand the punishment. And that's why, by the way, I think now we can answer a question that I raised last week. Because if you remember, last week we said that Adam did not admit his chait. In other words, he tried to blame it on the woman. In other words, Chazal criticized. His answer was, Aisha, he blames it on the woman. That, the woman you placed there with me, she gave me of the fruit, and I ate. So he has a denial of responsibility. He disclaims responsibility, deflects, he blames it on the woman, and indirectly he blames it on God. Hashem Asati Madi. He's blaming it on God. Now, would you say, on the surface, the woman seems to be doing the same thing. But now, in light of this interpretation, would you say that when the woman said, is she also guilty of disclaiming unwillingness to accept responsibility? Or would you say that, because, or not? Or is this different? In other words, according to this interpretation, you see, the woman is not criticized for her answer, as other men is criticized. According to this interpretation, because if the snake is external, so then she should be guilty of doing the same thing that that other men is doing. But if the snake is the etara, then it's an ambition. Then she's confessing. Hanocha shishiani. I was overcome. I was seduced. And that's, by the way, all the term proper term would be seduced. All fate is really seduction. Can someone explain what I mean? All fate is really seduction. And by the way, that it's a seduction. We can explain it ourselves. What does it mean? That fate is really seduction. You're seduced for the moment into believing that this is really the good. This is really going to make you happy. Your instinct overcomes and seduces the reason, the intelligence, to cease functioning and to go along with the belief. Because a person only thinks because he believes that this is really a good thing. At the moment of chay, he really believes that this is the good. That if I must have this, and that if I just had this, then everything will be okay. Everything will be okay. That's the seduction. His reason. His reason is to do it. And that's what she was saying. Anocha shishiani. I was seduced by the snake. Now, God said, because you did this, you are more cursed. We'll just try and understand this aspect of today. We'll be satisfied if we can understand Pasuk Gadol. Because you did this, you are more cursed than all the animals and all the beasts of the field. What does that mean? What does it mean? In what sense are the animals cursed? That's the first thing we have to understand. That's a difficult idea. I'm sorry? This has been applied also to the earth. God cursed the earth. What does that mean that God cursed the earth? We read later on that God cursed Arura Ha'adama Baburecha. Cursed is the earth, the ground, the land is cursed also. Now, what does that mean? That's in Pasuk Yudayim. That was part of the punishment of Adam, that the earth was cursed because of him. And that's the Sevan Tachlana. Now, what does that mean? I think in that sense, the term curse, I'm sorry, let me recall, so the Sforno says, Sheyasik Tavosav Yitzrachov B'tzar U'v'chisaram, that he will achieve his desires and his needs with pain and with loss, U'v'chisaram Tainos, and with a diminished enjoyment. Yoseh recall She'or Balei Chayim, more than any other animal. What does it mean? I think the term curse means, what does it mean God cursed the earth? It means that God placed certain impediments in the way of fulfilling the objective. In other words, a curse would be to have an impediment in the way of the fulfillment of the objective. That's to be cursed. It's only a curse. In other words, if a creature is in line with its purpose, so then it's fine. That's not cursed. But to be cursed means to be deflected from your course, from your purpose. Now the thing is like this, in a certain sense, the more needs that a creature has, the more, quote, cursed it is, in the sense that there's greater obstacles in the line of its fulfillment. In other words, there's certain difficulties. You see, in other words, the simpler a creature is, the simpler its needs, the simpler it is to obtain. Like simple grass, doesn't need much, rain, this, whatever, no problem. Now the animal life, the simpler the mechanism, the less cursed. In a sense, there are less problems involved. When God cursed the earth, it means he created more difficulties, more obstacles to be overcome. Then even animals in that sense have a curse. Because animals have to hunt, they have to go through hunger, they have to... So in other words, even though basically they're in line with their nature, but they too have obstacles in the path of their fulfillment. No. That was the way it was. No. God did not make any change for the animals. Had man not sinned, then his instinctual nature would have been more easily satisfied. But now there's a curse. Now, due to the fact that you sin, you are more cursed in the sense that for you to satisfy your instinctual nature is going to be extremely difficult. It's going to be more problems, more obstacles, more difficulties. Now, what are the difficulties? Al defan fatelech, you will travel on your belly. The ofar tochah, what does that mean? Al defan fatelech. Animals, the satisfaction of their instinctual needs, even though, as we said, it's not without obstacles, an animal too has to go about searching for its needs, has to find food, has to stalk its prey. Sometimes it has to fight to get the female, you know, to have sexual and so forth. But it's relatively easy. But now man, due to the fact that he has sinned, and due to the fact that he now has a superego, it's extremely complex. I mean, two animals, they don't need much. Animals have a sexual instinct, they get together, they mate, and that's it. That's the end of that. But not with people, with Adam. I mean, you can't just go directly and satisfy your needs. And you have to go through a whole long ritual. I mean, you know yourself, everybody knows, take a look at the world at large. I mean, people spend all their, people that are involved in the wrong, you know, they're not involved in chokhmah, and they're just trying to live the instinctual life. Even that's not so simple. You can't just walk over to a man or a guy just can't walk up to a girl and say, okay, we have instinct. But it doesn't work that way. You got to go through a whole rigmarole, right? There's the dating, and then there's the bar, and going around the subject, and going to this and that, and all the expenditures, and hanging out, and dressing a certain way, and saying the right words, not saying the wrong words, not coming on too quickly, there's a whole of the chonchate. In other words, it's very, very complex. It's very difficult to achieve your instinctual needs. And that's true in every area. You see, with food also, it's not so simple. An animal, basically, you can feed an animal the same thing every day. But with Adam also, it's difficult. You're not satisfied. You want other things. People who go to fine restaurants and so on. There's a complete change. A complete change in the way in which the instinctual part of man is satisfied. It can't go directly to its cause. The Adachon Fatelus means it doesn't take the direct, the most efficient route to its objective. In order to achieve its objective, it has to go round and round about ways, because of the complex nature of man's psyche. And what's the upper tochal? You see, because in the instinctual, you realize I'm not explaining it too elaborately. You don't get the point? You got to satisfy your superego. So that's why he can't. Although in our society it's getting diminished, it used to be different. But the average man, the average woman, we'll take the sexual as an example, unless a person's at a very low level, like a person that would be regarded as just a bad behavior, most people aren't on that level. So therefore, they have to work out some kind of a romantic framework, some kind of where they're still able to retain a certain sense of decency about themselves. They can't just get together and have sexual relations. The whole rigmarole. And that creates all kinds of complications, and a tremendous amount of energy is wasted in fantasy and romance and imagination and disappointment. And for all the amount of effort, you know, people that hang out, let's say, singles in New York, all the amount they're going every night and spending time having these conversations and this and starting a relationship and this, there's a tremendous amount of effort and hours and how much satisfaction is gotten from all that. It's like anyone that's involved in the scene basically wants to get out of it. They're not happy. I mean, maybe to an outsider it may look glamorous, but when you're in it, it's very painful. You talk to people that live that life, and they know it's extremely painful. They got to spend hours talking and this and that and satisfying the emotions. And if you would work out a ratio of the amount of genuine happiness, genuine satisfaction, as opposed to tremendous amounts of anticipation and suffering and anxiety and waiting and phone calls and everything you have to do, it's not worth it. I mean, it's bad news. The animal doesn't have that. So in that sense, Adam is more cursed, even in the instinctual. And the idea of it means to say, and when you finally do, see, it's interesting. It's like, what does it mean, dust? Yeah. You don't enjoy, it's talking about the instinctual. See, if a person, who enjoys life the most? The one who's involved in something. See, that was the lesson that God taught the Jews by Marah. They couldn't drink the water because it was bitter, and they started to complain. That's the case by Marah. So Moshe took a tree. He took a tree which is bitter and threw it into the water which was bitter. There's an idea. The bitter cured the bitter. He was teaching them an idea. The reason why you're not satisfied is because you're fully involved in the taiva, in the fantasy. A person who's involved in the taiva can't enjoy the taiva. Who enjoys the physical life the most? The person that's involved in chachma. See, before the chet, before, when a person is involved, all of his energy is involved in chachma, in reality, in knowledge, in study. But then when the appetite comes upon him, then he eats, he enjoys the eating. Then when he's involved in the sexual, he enjoys the sexual. And then his energy goes back to chachma, to learning. But people that are involved in pursuing the fantasies, they don't enjoy it at all. Because for them, the fantasy is so great that when they finally get there, it's nothing but disappointment. In other words, people that are pursuing the, and that's what people are pursuing, the ultimate vacation, the ultimate this, the ultimate that. In other words, when they direct, they really believe that the true good for man lies in fulfilling his imaginary desires, the world of the of fantasy, the world of the imagination, the world of the physical. Those people are miserable. They're totally miserable. Because the actuality doesn't satisfy them. And that's why it's a crazy, that's why they turn to drugs. People that are involved in the physical the whole time, they can't be satisfied. They're disappointed. They have to try other things. The crazier things. You know, all kinds of crazy, I don't have to enumerate, you know what I'm talking about. So new kinds of experiences. Groups, this, that, all kinds of deviations. This took place in the Dharamabha. But the whole world became corrupt. Because once a person directs all of his energy towards finding the happiness in the physical, he experiences disappointment. But instead of recognizing that he's making a mistake and to withdraw from that area, no, so he'll just try other things. And he keeps going, then he gets tired of that and tries other things. And then he gets really miserable, so then he has to have drugs. Now, why is drugs such a prominent part of our culture today? Because of that miserable unhappiness due to the fact that they're totally involved in the physical fantasy, that this is the good. And that leads to nothing but disillusionment and disappointment. The only person that can enjoy the world was created only for someone who's a tzaddik. Because the person who's a tzaddik has true happiness because he's involved with the in chachma, it's just the opposite. You start out in chachma, you really don't associate this with having a great time. People look forward to an event, they're having a party, you know, that's a party, you know, or they're going to a wedding or a party or this and that. They build up a tremendous thing. Then they go there and after a while, you're bored. All right, how much can you eat? How much can you, you know, how much can you eat? It's boring. And you go to a lot of weddings, it's boring after a while. How much can you dance? How much can you hear the same songs? How much can you eat? It's boring. Then you get excited about a new party and then it's boring. But a person that in chachma, it's just the opposite. Nobody wakes up, wow, I'm going to learn, and you can't wait to get learning. Nobody feels like that. He's smart, he realizes that he's supposed to learn, he goes, and then it's just the opposite. Then when he gets involved, he can't believe how enjoyable it was. The experience is just the opposite. Instead of disappointment, it's surprise at how fantastic this is. Like, I can't believe it. I never expect to have such a good time. Very often a person will go to a shiur because he feels he has to go, whatever the thing is. He doesn't, all right, he's going. And if it's a good shiur, and he's really involved, and he learns something, he walks away, he's like amazed. I never really thought I was going to enjoy this. This is fantastic. And of course, if he's smart, he'll make the proper deductions. And he'll, but that's the whole idea. The person that's involved in chachma has the greatest life. because he's constantly experiencing the amazement. It never is disappointing. He never has the idea that, oh, okay. It's just the opposite. He's always happily surprised. And then, you see, since his energy is not involved in the fantasy of the physical, when he partakes of the physical, he's satisfying a real need, not an imaginary need. That's when you really enjoy it, when you're hungry. See, when does a person enjoy something? When it's really satisfying a genuine need. But people that are just living involved in fantasy, it's not satisfying a genuine need. It's trying to satisfy a fantasy. That's impossible. Because the reality will never live up to the fantasy. So that's the concept. That's the curse of the nachas. Next week.